or a cloth they brought with them, and each section of 250 squares roped off to form aisles, held approximately 2,000 people when all units were filled. By the time Billy and Ruth, who had spent time at a boarding school in North Korea as a girl, arrived at the island in the late afternoon, the crowd control chart indicated that the dreamed-of throng of 300,000 was already in place. By the time the service started, it appeared that 500,000 people were sitting quietly, waiting to worship God and to listen to Billy Graham. Ruth later wrote in her diary that it was one of those things impossible to take in, and Billy could not hide the awe in his voice as he told the happy crowd that they were not only the largest audience he had ever preached to, but the largest audience ever to hear a preacher in person anywhere in the world. Almost always in top form when preaching with an interpreter, Graham seemed even more effective than usual in Seoul, as Billy Kim performed what almost anyone discussing these meetings seems convinced was the most impressive display of translation they had ever witnessed. Kim was so good, in fact, that some Korean television viewers assumed that he was the featured preacher, with Graham interpreting his message for American military personnel. As usual, some pastors and theologians criticized the sermons for their theological thinness. And also, as usual, the multitudes filled themselves happily with the simple loaves and fishes he offered them. When the services ended in the evening, thousands stayed afterward to pray, then bedded down right on the tarmac so they could attend a 5 a.m. prayer meeting before returning home or hurrying off to work, or, if they were from out of town, simply because they had no place else to go. The huge crowds continued to gather, and the secular press and television paid the crusade an unprecedented amount of positive attention. Even the North Korean media noted that a remarkable kind of witchcraft event was occurring in Seoul. Then, for the closing service on Sunday afternoon, an incredible, impossible thing happened. When Billy Graham stood up to speak, he faced a densely packed ribbon of people stretching 200 yards in front of him and half a mile to either side. According to the crowd control grid, 1,120,000 people, almost certainly the largest public religious gathering in history. Amazingly, what could have been a teeming multitude became instead a quiet congregation, able with the aid of a superb sound system to hear every word even at the farthest distance from the platform. The thousands of military policemen had little to do. One man in a million created a momentary stir with a brief and apparently aimless outburst. A few dozen people experienced minor medical problems, not one of which was serious. Few cities of a million inhabitants could match that record on any given afternoon. During his 12 weeks in London in 1954, and again during the 16 weeks in New York in 1957, Billy Graham had spoken to aggregate audiences of more than 2 million people. Now, in 5 days in Korea, he had addressed in person crowds totaling more than 3 million. Another 1.5 million attended the 6 associate crusades in other major cities. Inquirer cards from all the meetings exceeded 100,000. Billy Kim's church increased almost immediately by 30% in a spurt of growth, and its pastor, turned into a national figure by the crusade, gained a permanent spot in the front rank of Asian church leaders. The effect on Korean church people, as astonished as outsiders by what they had seen and wrought, was also immediate and dramatic. Kim speculates that Graham came to Korea in what Scripture calls the fullness of time, a time when momentum had reached the takeoff stage. If he had come in 63 or 83, he reflected, I doubt we could have pulled off a 73-style crusade. No question, 73 was a critical time. Dr. Han agreed that with the Billy Graham crusade, the Korean church came of age. Denominations and missionary agencies that had fought or ignored each other began to perceive each other as brethren who could accomplish more by working side by side. The already high growth rate nearly tripled over the next 2 years as Presbyterians established 700 new churches, While Baptist and Charismatic churches totted up proportionately similar gains. In 1977, a group of Korean evangelists secured Yoida Plaza for a crusade of their own with no help from Americans. According to Kim, they matched Billy Graham's million every night of the crusade. Finally, the Korean church began to see itself as a sender, not just a receiver of missionaries, as men trained in churches and denominational seminaries, and at such ecumenical institutions as the Asian Center for Theological Studies and Mission, whose library was endowed by a generous gift from BGEA, began themselves to take the gospel to foreign lands. By the mid-1980s, South Korea was producing more foreign missionaries than any nation in the world, save America, and possibly India. No one could foresee the details of these extraordinary developments following the wake of the 1973 crusade, but only the most obtuse could fail to recognize they were witnessing a wondrous thing. Secular observers would inevitably point to timing, to organization, to publicity, to the efforts of an eager minority to secure a place in a rapidly advancing society. But as a helicopter lifted him from Yoido Plaza and skimmed over the mile-long sea of handkerchiefs and white programs waving beneath in adoring gratitude, Billy Graham blinked with wonder and pronounced the only benediction he could fathom. This is the work of God. There is no other explanation. Chapter 26, Vietnam and Watergate. Graham fervently wanted to believe that America and Richard Nixon were also involved in the work of God. He had long seen America as especially blessed in return for its allegiance to Judeo-Christian principles, and since the mid-1950s had repeatedly urged Nixon to make his commitment to those principles more explicit, to say in public what Graham felt certain he believed deep in his heart. The goodness of America, if it would seek anew the vision of its founders, the greatness of Richard Nixon, if he would let it come to full flower, and his own ability to discern right from wrong, these were fundamental articles of Billy Graham's faith. Bedrock beliefs can withstand enormous challenge, but never in Graham's life had he been forced to deal with the cognitive dissonance posed for him by the two key issues of Richard Nixon's presidency: Vietnam and Watergate. And perhaps never in his life did he experience so much difficulty in facing the limits and inconsistencies and distortions of his own perceptions than in his efforts to try to come to terms with these egregious episodes in American history. The Nixon presidency had been a heady experience for Graham. His closeness to the White House had brought increased criticism, but that was bearable. Nixon won re-election in a landslide, and both he and his policies were generally admired by Graham's own constituency. Besides, for the most part, the detractors were people who had never much cared for Graham or his ministry. Even more important, Nixon's establishment of the White House church services and his encouragement of Graham's evangelistic efforts seemed part of the return to spiritual concerns that Billy perpetually longed for and frequently professed to see appearing on the horizon. After the second inauguration, he wrote a gushing note commending Nixon on what he deemed by far the finest inaugural address I have ever heard any president give. I have received many comments concerning the spiritual emphasis at the end. The note you struck touched a deep chord in America. You are one of the most thoughtful men I've ever known. Unhappily, he could not add that Nixon was one of the most generous people he had ever known. When the media reported that of $2 million he had earned during his presidency, Nixon contributed only $13,510 to charities and churches, including a paltry $1,250 to the Whittier Congregation of Friends and $4,500 to BGEA. Graham registered surprise at the small amount he reported giving to charities in relation to his total income, but added that there may be some other explanation, in that his finances and contributions were left to other people. Graham's perception of increased spiritual concern on Nixon's part emboldened him to push for measures he hoped might nudge America closer to becoming the righteous republic he was certain God wanted it to be. He had been predictably upset in 1962 and 1963 by the Supreme Court decisions banning prayer and devotional reading of the Bible in public schools. He once opined that the few atheists who object to Bible reading in schools should be overruled by the majority, and briefly considered leading a movement to restore school-mandated prayer. He bowed for a time to the court's commitment to pluralism, though its secularist tendency so dismayed him that in 1970 he recommended that Protestants consider establishing a massive system of parochial schools, a vision whose incarnation, though largely independent of action on his part, became one of the key institutional segments of the Christian New Right within a decade. Now, however, he seemed ready to experiment with the civil religion he and Richard Nixon were constantly being accused of trying to impose on America. At the first White House service, following the 1973 inauguration, Graham recommended that the Ten Commandments be read in every public school classroom in America. It would, he ventured, be less controversial than prayer, and surely all Judeo-Christian people could agree on its precepts. He failed to acknowledge that a rapidly growing segment of Americans did not fit into the categories of Jew or Christian. Neither did he seem to appreciate that with their prohibitions of worshiping gods other than Yahweh, taking God's name in vain, making graven images, and violating the Sabbath, the Ten Commandments were not simply general moral principles, but explicit theological tenets. When reporters asked Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was present at the service, if Graham's suggestion might raise constitutional questions, Burger replied, "At this time it would," but that seemed not to discourage the evangelist. At one point he volunteered that if the Ten Commandments would not pass the court's test of neutrality, he would settle for Mao's eight values. Speak politely. Pay fairly for what you damage. Repay debts fairly. Do not hit or swear at people. Do not damage crops. Do not take liberties with women. And do not mistreat captives. But when that concession to pluralism drew fire from some who feared he might be growing soft on communism, he returned to recommending the Ten Commandments. Graham's critics were quick to point out the problems and inconsistencies of such positions. But it was not these issues that disturbed them most. A far greater concern were Vietnam and Watergate, issues on which they felt no man who had the president's ear should remain silent. Graham liked to say, "I am not a Nathan," referring to the prophet who called King David to account for his adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. In his mind, the alternative was an evangelist like Paul, who preached wherever he was given opportunity, including the courts of kings and governors, but did not occupy himself with trying to rectify the injustices of the Roman Empire. His critics, however, continued to feel that his refusal to speak out early and boldly against American policy in Vietnam and later, against the Nixon administration's role in the execution and attempted cover-up of the Watergate break-in, smacked not of the Apostle Paul, whose preaching resulted in his own imprisonment and martyrdom, but of Zedekiah, the proud and colorful false prophet of Israel, who won a favored spot in the court of Ahab by telling the king what he wanted to hear, confirming a course of action that ended his reign in death and disgrace, with the dogs of Samaria licking up his blood. Graham dealt with his confusion over Vietnam by refusing to comment on it during 1972. He was flushed out of that bunker, however, when the United States resumed heavy bombing of North Vietnam in mid-December of that year, setting off fresh waves of angry protest across America. Prodded by the press and fellow clergymen, including the Reverend Ernest Campbell of New York's Riverside Church, who preached a sermon entitled An Open Letter to Billy Graham, in which he implored the evangelist to use his influence with Nixon to try to stop the bombing. Graham broke his self-imposed silence early in January 1973. In a widely distributed press release, he set forth what he claimed was the posture he had assumed throughout the war. In regard to the conflict in Southeast Asia, he said, "I have avoided expressions as to who was right and who was wrong. Naturally, I have come under criticism from both hawks and doves for my position. During all this time, though, I had repeatedly indicated my hope for a rapid and just peace in Southeast Asia. I have regretted that this war has gone on so long and has been such a divisive force in America. I hope and pray that there will be an early armistice. He pointed out that although the Bible would indicate we always have wars on the earth until the beginning again of the Prince of Peace, he did not take that as justification for indifference or complacency. I have never advocated war, he said. I deplore it. I also deplore the violence everywhere throughout the world that evidences man's inhumanity to man. I am therefore praying for every responsible effort which seeks true peace in our time. In response to the suggestion that he urged Nixon to stop the bombing, which had in fact been stopped a few days before he released his statement, Graham scoffed at the popular picture of him as some kind of White House chaplain, pointing out that his relationship to Nixon was little different from Cardinal Cushing's relationship to John Kennedy. He also insisted that his influence on Nixon had been overdrawn. The president doesn't call me up and say, "Billy, should we do this or that?" That just doesn't happen. I'm not one of his confidants. I'm not one of his advisors. I'm just a personal friend. That's all. In no way would he ask me military strategy. He's never even discussed it with me. If I have something to say to President Nixon, I'll do it privately, and I won't announce it from the housetops with a lot of publicity. Even if the president did seek his advice on secular matters, Graham claimed he would be reluctant to give it, a statement that neatly finessed two decades of documented action to the contrary. I'm convinced, he asserted, that God has called me to be a New Testament evangelist, not an Old Testament prophet. While some may interpret an evangelist to be primarily a social reformer or political activist, I do not. An evangelist is a proclaimer of the message of God's love and grace in Jesus Christ, and the necessity of repentance and faith. The New York Times published another interview with Graham on the weekend of the inauguration, just 6 days before the signing of the truce agreement in Paris on January 27, 1973. He claimed he had doubted from the beginning the wisdom of sending American troops anywhere without the will to win. It seemed to him, he said, that we entered the war almost deliberately to lose it. I don't think we should ever fight these long, drawn-out, half-hearted wars. It's like cutting a cat's tail off a half inch at a time. Still, he conceded that the December resumption of the bombing of North Vietnam had dismayed him. I'll be honest with you, he said. I felt gloomy. Like all Americans, I thought a ceasefire was imminent. Rather than let those widely shared and quite comprehensible statements stand alone, however, Graham minimized the significance of the war by noting once again that it was just one example of violence in a world filled with tragedy. There are hundreds of thousands of deaths attributed to smoking, he said. 1,000 people are killed every week on American highways, he noted, and half of those are attributed to alcohol. Where are the demonstrations against alcohol? By this time, Graham had settled on an official version of his role with regard to the war. He told the New York Times, Christianity Today, and anyone else who asked, that in all the history of the Vietnam conflict, he had made only one public comment that could be construed as support for the war. That lone remark, made before the United States became deeply involved in the war, had been an offhand response to a question. Moreover, he wasn't even certain what he had said on that occasion. But I know that as soon as I said it, I wished I hadn't. Graham's critics were not impressed. Union Seminary's John C. Bennett observed that when people claim to be above politics, it is axiomatic that they, in effect, support the status quo. Elaborating on this point, others charged that it was precisely Graham's silence that accounted for his popularity with the president. Since he was unwilling to criticize them on any matter of substance, he was perceived by them and by the public to be in favor of whatever policy they espoused. In specific response to that criticism, a BGA spokesman explained that if he took a position for or against certain policies, he would alienate people on one side or another. And this is not what he set out to do. It is true that Graham had felt deep disquiet over the war for several years, It is true that he made some effort, as in his Bangkok meeting with missionaries, to discern both the positives and negatives of American policy, and conduct and to suggest ways in which the war might be brought to a swift and satisfactory conclusion. It is also true, however, that his consistent characterization of war protesters as misguided, extremist, or even disloyal, and his refusal to criticize American policy in Southeast Asia could easily be interpreted as support for that policy. That is how much of the public and many of his fellow clergy viewed his position. And that is certainly how the White House viewed it. In April 1972, Haldeman had instructed Colson that calls should be made before the president's Wednesday night speech to Billy Graham, Bob Hope, Cardinal Kroll, and others of that sort, the hardline type, who support us. They should be urged to watch the speech because the president will be making some very important points that they will find helpful. Apparently Graham wanted the White House to consider him a supporter. As soon as the media began to pick up on his press release deploring all war and violence and urging a rapid and just peace in Southeast Asia, Dwight Chapin informed Haldeman that Graham wanted to be in touch with him and with the president. "He is very disturbed," Chapin reported, "by some press reports which quote him as saying the war is deplorable." When the Paris Accord ended the war less than a week into the second Nixon administration, Graham could not resist a bit of private crowing. In a note of congratulations, he told the president, "Some of the liberal commentators seem to be disappointed that you were able to do it. Now, perhaps with the war behind him, Nixon could unshackle his latent spirituality and help heal America's wounds by leading it back to God." First, of course, he would have to attend to his own salvation. "It is my prayer," the evangelist wrote, "that during these next 4 years, you will put your total trust in the same Christ that your dear mother so firmly believed in." Unfortunately for Nixon, for Graham, and for the nation, the dark form taking shape on the horizon was not a whirlwind of revival, but the specter of Watergate. When operatives of the Committee to Re-elect the President, CREEP, broke into offices of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate apartment complex in June 1972, few could have foreseen that the early trickles of indignation would eventually become a flood of outrage that would sweep Richard Nixon from office and deposit several of his key associates in prison. Clearly, Graham did not treat it as an act of great consequence. When George McGovern depicted what some were calling a caper as instead an example of the ethical poverty of the Republican administration, Graham characterized his attack as a desperate move, a sign that he knew he could not defeat Nixon on the more important issues of the campaign. In a note to Haldeman, he observed that, "It is amazing to me that people who made a hero of Daniel Ellsberg for stealing the Pentagon Papers are so deeply concerned about the alleged escapade at Watergate." 5 months later, after federal judge John Sirica ordered 7 defendants in the case, including G. Gordon Liddy and James W. McCord, Jr., to appear before a grand jury to explore possible high-level involvement in the break-in, and after McCord told a closed Senate hearing that John Mitchell, former attorney general and head of CREEP, had known of plans for the break-in before it occurred, Graham's primary response was one of admiration for the aplomb Nixon demonstrated while his enemy snapped at his ankles. "I have marveled at your restraint as the rumors fly about Watergate." He wrote, "King David had the same experience. He said, 'They accuse me of things I have never even heard about. I do them good, but they return me harm.'" Psalm 35, verses 11 through 12. Graham apparently believed Nixon was certain to emerge unscathed. Quoting a modern language translation of Proverbs chapter 19, verse 20, he predicted, "If you profit from constructive criticism, you will be elected to the Wise Men's Hall of Fame." As evidence mounted that, indeed, Watergate had not been simply a caper performed by an overzealous freelance cadre of CREEP plumbers, but a carefully planned expedition, ordered and subsequently covered up by men quite close to and possibly including Richard Nixon himself. Graham took some steps to clear himself of any possible stain that might wash over him. New York Times publisher Arthur Oakes, Punch Sulzberger, was a good friend, he explained. During Watergate, he offered me the use of his op-ed page to write whatever I wanted, and I wrote two articles distancing myself to some extent. He also gave interviews to AP religion writer George Cornell and the Today Show and made some of the same observations on an Hour of Decision broadcast in May. Of course, he acknowledged, I have been mystified and confused and sick about the whole thing, as I think every American has. He felt certain the president was not seriously involved, since his moral and ethical principles wouldn't allow him to do anything illegal like that. And he decried the trial by media and by rumor. At the same time, he called for the dismissal and punishment of everybody connected with Watergate, labeled the scandal as a symptom of the deeper moral crisis brought on by amoral permissiveness that would make Sodom blush, and called on Americans to engage in some deep soul-searching about the underpinnings of our society and our goals as a nation, to take the law of Moses and the Sermon on the Mount seriously, and to show concern for an honest and efficient government at all levels. As he called on the nation to learn the deeper lessons of Watergate, Graham was counseling the White House to make the task more difficult. After Haldeman, Ehrlichman, John Dean, and Attorney General Richard Kleindienst resigned, in anticipation of the Senate hearing scheduled to begin in mid-May, Graham called Larry Higbee to suggest that Nixon and his staff take immediate measures to divert the public's attention from the Watergate affair. He suggested, Higbee told the president, that wherever possible, we create picture situations such as the one yesterday with you and Willie Brandt. This causes public focus on the fact that the president is not bogged down on one issue, but is working in other areas. He feels the more of this type of thing we can do, the better. The American people need to be diverted from Watergate. 2 days later, North Carolina Senator Jesse Helm dropped a note to Nixon, reporting that, I chatted at some length yesterday afternoon with Billy Graham. I need not tell you that you have a real friend there. Do not allow the present circumstances to worry you. Your friends understand, and we are confident that right will prevail. God bless you. These letters and verbal messages delivered through aides and friends served a double purpose. Not only did they transmit information he wanted the president to have, they also enabled him to say with a straight face and perhaps a clear conscience that he and the president had never discussed Watergate. By midsummer, it was clear that Watergate might well become Waterloo. Senator Sam Ervin opened the Senate hearings by announcing the investigating committee's intention to uncover all the relevant facts and spare no one, whatever his station in life might be. John Dean pointed his finger at several folk of quite high station, and Alex Butterfield astonished the committee and the public by revealing that nearly all of the conversations in the Oval Office since early 1971 had been taped on a secret recording system. Now, with the possibility of finding out exactly what had gone on in that office, no series of picture situations, however well orchestrated, stood a chance of diverting attention from Watergate. This was the story, and it would be played out to the end. Graham had not visited the White House since the inauguration, and had talked with the president on the telephone only 4 times since February, so his views on Watergate were necessarily rather speculative. In one of his more memorable speculations, he ventured that Watergate was just another sign of permissiveness, a diagnosis that seemed a bit off the mark when applied to Gordon Liddy and John Mitchell, who helped plan it, and the arrow-straight gentleman in the White House who helped cover it up. He also volunteered that it was too early to make any moral judgments about what had happened, apparently overlooking the fact that if the conspirators in the case had not considered burglary and illegal wiretapping to be at least borderline behaviors, they would probably not have made blackmail payments and suborned perjury to try to keep it from coming to light. As the year ground on, Nixon's situation worsened. Spiro Agnew, a man seldom accused of permissiveness, resigned in disgrace after pleading no contest to government charges of income tax evasion related to kickbacks received from government contractors when he was governor of Maryland. Nixon at first refused Judge Sirica's request that the secret tapes be turned over to Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. Then he fired Cox and lost Attorney General Elliot Richardson and Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus in the infamous Saturday Night Massacre. Faced with a growing threat of impeachment, he finally agreed to release the tapes. In the face of this monumental and truculent recalcitrance, Graham issued a Thanksgiving statement in which he said, "I applaud the President for his courageous revelation of detailed facts of Watergate. I think the people want the facts, and I'm confident he will continue to give them. Despite his ability to discern courage where few others spotted it, Graham could not avoid seeing that his friend was in deep trouble. Still, he expected him to survive." Those who suspected he was weakening physically and psychologically should be reassured, he said, adding that it is quite evident that the President is not going to resign, and I doubt that the Senate would vote to remove him from office. If that is the case, and I believe it is, we should rally around the three branches of our government with our prayers and our support. Then in the first of what would become a series of subtle distancing maneuvers, Graham admitted that "I do not always agree with the judgment and policies of his administration, but President Nixon has my support and prayers." Since even the dissenters and the doubters should realize that, in all probability, Mr. Nixon will be the only president we have for the next 3 years. He thought it reasonable that all Americans, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, offer that same kind of support. He concluded the statement with the hopeful prediction that the tragic events of Watergate will probably make him a strong man and a better president. It was less than unqualified approbation, and it lacked the usual promise of certain victory, but Richard Nixon could not afford to turn down any offer of support. On Thanksgiving afternoon, the president called Graham at his home in Montreat to thank him for his kind words. On Sunday, December 16, Graham officiated at the White House Christmas service, and either before or afterward spoke briefly with the president by telephone. In a letter thanking Nixon for the invitation and the conversation, Graham reaffirmed my personal affection for you as a man, my appreciation for our long friendship, and my complete confidence in your personal integrity. Later that week, and again in a note at Christmas, he complimented Nixon for being so chipper and full of fun in the face of adversity. "Certainly the Lord has sustained you in a remarkable way. Lesser men would have folded long ago." Then offering a prediction that showed the wisdom in his consistent rejection of the status of prophet, he said, "I am sure that this coming year will be far better than 1973. The new year began on a low note for the president, as his old and dear friend put a bit more distance between himself and the mess of Watergate. In an interview published in the January 4, 1974 edition of Christianity Today, Graham decided he finally had sufficient evidence to justify handing down a moral decision. He characterized both the break-in and the cover-up as not only unethical, but criminal, and said, "I can make no excuses for Watergate. I condemn it, and I deplore it. It has hurt America." While acknowledging that Nixon had shown poor judgment, especially in the selection of certain people, he noted that there was as yet no proof the president was directly involved in either the break-in or the cover-up. And he reasserted his continuing confidence in Nixon's integrity. He had made mistakes, to be sure, but if he admitted them and thereby regained his credibility with the public, he could be a stronger president than ever before. In a similar vein, Graham denied that his having spoken at the White House Christmas service was in any sense a benediction of what had been going on there. Graham gave Nixon advance warning of the CT interview and wrote a note thanking him for understanding why he felt it necessary to say what he had said. Nixon's actual response had not been preserved, but some of his supporters regarded Graham's statements as little short of outright betrayal. As staunch Republican business executive George Stringfellow wrote to ask why he had found it necessary to note that Nixon had made mistakes. "Did you need publicity?" He noted further that in a television speech, Graham had made a point of associating himself with the late President Johnson. "I suppose this was done to further dissociate yourself from President Nixon?" Then in a parting shot, Stringfellow reported that he had recently attended a dinner at which Graham's remarks had been brought up, prompting an observation by one of the men present that Nixon's ship is listing. When the water reaches the upper level, the rats leave the ship. In concluding his letter, Stringfellow noted the diners had agreed that the ship will right itself by next June. If it serves your vanity at that time, you will be headed up the gangplank again. Stringfellow was not alone in his judgment of Graham's behavior and motives. Norman Vincent Peale, who reaffirmed his own admiration and affection for Graham, wrote to say, "Billy, I have just got to tell you that I was saddened by your recent reported statements about President Nixon. It appeared that you were trying to get out from under and were not standing by the man for whom you have professed abiding friendship." Peale had seen a copy of Stringfellow's letter, and while admitting it was direct, said, "I must confess that it represents the views of many, myself included. As for me, I'm sticking with President Nixon 100%, all the way. I believe in him absolutely, and I've been totally unaffected by the vicious attacks upon him." Peale subsequently sent a copy of his letter to Nixon, who responded with a gracious note of appreciation. Graham, however, was not alone among Nixon's friends, and seeing the need for the chief executive to admit his mistakes, Charles Colson, regarded as one of the toughest in Nixon's inner circle, the man said to have boasted he would run over his grandmother if she got in his way, responded to the pressures of Watergate by accepting an invitation to join a small group of Washington political figures who met regularly for prayer and discussion. Within a short time, Colson experienced what the intervening years have shown to be a genuine, life-changing conversion. When word of that conversion leaked out, cynics hooted at what they took to be a blatant effort to gain sympathy with the public, and more importantly, with any judge or jury that might try him for his role in the Watergate cover-up. Internal White House memos, however, suggest that Colson's transformation was not only genuine, but posed a bit of an inconvenience for the staff. In late November, as he looked ahead to the National Prayer Breakfast in January, Colson complained to the president that the breakfast had become simply another big Washington gathering that people must attend, asserting that its religious significance as a day for government leaders to join together in sincere prayer has been lost. He urged Nixon to schedule a second, smaller breakfast with a bipartisan group that unanimously wants to pray with and for you. Colson believes such attention to spiritual matters was essential. "I have thought long and hard about how the ordeal of Watergate will finally come to an end. I believe that the country has to be lifted out of the doldrums of Watergate. Our best hope is to bring about a rebirth of faith and a renewed commitment to God. It is that national commitment that has seen America through its darkest and most perilous times. I know that there are millions of Americans who would pray with and for you if they were asked to do so. The experiment may well in fact renew the American spirit. I believe, too, that this would begin the reconciliation that would enable you to lead the country out of these troubled times." Colson continued to press for a second, real prayer breakfast. But Nixon brought the matter to an end by dispatching a succinct verdict on the matter. "Two breakfasts are too many." As one of the prayer breakfast's pioneers, Graham saw no particular need to revamp its format. But he did think it would be a splendid opportunity for the president to come clean. On several previous occasions, he had offered suggestions as to what Nixon might say in addresses before religious groups. His recommendations for this occasion included the statement, "I hope I shall not be judged as hiding behind religion when I say that I have, like many of my predecessors before me, been driven to my knees in prayer. We are all in need of God's forgiveness, not only for mistakes and judgment, but our sins as well." He also urged the president to sprinkle some verses of Scripture into his talks. One of the most appropriate, he thought, might be God's instruction to King Solomon in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. "If my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." For a closing line, Graham suggested that the president say, I want to take this opportunity today to rededicate myself to the God that I first learned about at my mother's knee. The White House was not thrilled to receive Graham's suggestions. Alexander Haig passed them along to Nixon with a recommendation that he read them, since Graham may ask about them. But he characterized them as replete with Watergate mea culpa, and branded them totally unacceptable from my point of view. Apparently Nixon also found them unacceptable. He recalled a conversation with his Quaker grandmother about prayer, but chose not to use the breakfast as an occasion either to confess fault or rededicate his life to Christ. In the months that followed, the president was named a Watergate co-conspirator. His top aides were sentenced to federal prison, and after resisting a House Judiciary Committee subpoena on grounds of executive privilege, Nixon finally released extensive edited transcripts of the White House tapes. In recalling that period of national anguish, Graham has often claimed that he had been informed that Nixon had told his staff, "Don't let Billy Graham near me. I don't want to drag him into this mess." Without claiming perfect recall, he has told various inquirers that he and the president talked once, twice, or perhaps not at all between January 31, the date of the prayer breakfast, and August 23, when Nixon resigned, and that several attempts to reach Nixon met a stone wall. The White House contact file lists four conversations between the two men, one each in February, April, May, and June, but only one of these lasted more than 6 minutes. Charles Colson did not remember any such directive from Nixon. "I wasn't aware of it," he said, "and it would surprise me if that were true. I don't know how Watergate would have touched Billy. In those days, Nixon was looking for friends, and I would think Billy could get through just like that." Haldeman echoed Colson's skepticism. "Based on my knowledge of Nixon and the way he worked," he said, "I would need a lot more proof before I would believe it." The contact file, which records uncompleted calls or the name of the person who took the call in the president's stead, reflects no unsuccessful attempts. Whatever the precise details, it is clear Graham had only limited contact with Nixon during his last 7 months in office, at least in part because he spent much of that period in South Africa, Korea, and Europe. On the last day of April, Nixon went on television to announce that he was releasing edited transcripts of the Watergate tapes. The House Judiciary Committee insisted that edited transcripts were not an adequate substitute for the tapes themselves. But the transcripts were hardly a disappointment to those who had long viewed Richard Nixon as the dark beast of American politics. As excerpts began to appear in the national media, reporters pressed Graham for a reaction. In a striking manifestation of an all-too-common tendency of fundamentalists and evangelicals to focus on readily observed and easily categorized externals of behavior rather than on deeper and more fundamental pathologies, Graham fastened on the omnipresent profanity in the conversation between Nixon and his aides, a characteristic of the transcripts that made expletive deleted a household phrase for a time. Though he recognized that Nixon was not the first occupant of the White House to use profanity, he could not agree with Father John McLaughlin's blithe dismissal of the president's language as a form of therapy with no moral meaning. He noted that, "I have known five presidents, and I suspect if we had the transcripts of their conversations, they too would contain salty language." Still, he confessed, "I just didn't know that he used this type of language in talking to others. I rarely heard him say anything except hell or damn, and he would usually say, 'Excuse me, Billy.'" That the President of the United States, a man he considered to be one of his dearest friends, a man charged with conspiring to commit and cover up political espionage and facing almost certain impeachment, had been revealed to the world as a secret swear seemed almost incomprehensible. "I don't approve of that kind of language," he said. "God will not hold him guiltless." After the first of these reactions had been reported, Nixon reached Graham early one morning in his hotel room in Scottsdale, Arizona, the day before he would begin a crusade in Phoenix. They talked for only 3 minutes, and Graham reported that he just wanted to say hello. Perhaps the president hoped for some expression of forgiveness, which Graham would surely have given if asked. More likely, since he knew what else the transcripts told and Billy did not, he wanted one last conversation, however brief, in which at least a remnant of the mutual assumptions that had sustained their friendship for nearly 25 years was still intact. Graham finished the Phoenix Crusade, attendance 240,195, with 9,718 inquirers, in mid-May, and returned home to Montreat. At first he avoided the grim task he knew he must eventually face, but finally, after fretting and moping about for several days, he shut himself in his study and began working through the New York Times edition of excerpts from the transcripts. What he found there devastated him. He wept, he threw up, and he almost lost his innocence about Richard Nixon. "Those tapes revealed a man I never knew," he confessed. "I never saw that side of him." Recalling his profound disillusionment years later, Ruth called it the hardest thing that Bill has ever gone through personally. He confided to an inquirer that, "I'd had a real love for him. He'd always been very attentive to his friends. He never forgot a birthday. He seemed to love his country, love his children, love Pat. His thoughtfulness. There's a reason why so many people were loyal to him for so many years. I thought he was a man of such great integrity. I really looked upon him as the greatest possibility ever for leading this country on into its greatest and finest days. He had the character for it. I'd never, ever heard him tell a lie. But then the way it sounded in those tapes, it was all something totally foreign to me and him. He was just suddenly somebody else." The pain of that perception grew even sharper as Graham confronted the possibility that Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower might also have shown him only one of several faces. And inevitably, he had to confront his own possible, if unwitting, collusion in helping to do unto others as had been done unto him. Graham told one reporter that as he pored through the transcripts, "There were moments when I thought like Wesley when he said, 'When I look into my heart, it looks like hell.'" That may be, but a few days later, when he issued a press release containing his considered reaction to the transcripts, his angst had shrunk back to quite manageable dimensions. One might reasonably have hoped that he would comment on the manipulation of appearances, on the cynical use of power and people, on the willful obstruction of justice, on the threat Watergate posed to a government of laws. Instead, the transgression Graham once again singled out as most distressing to him was one whose guilt he did not share. "I must confess," he said, "that this has been a profoundly disturbing and disappointing experience." One cannot but deplore the moral tone implied in these papers. And though we know that other presidents have used equally objectionable language, it does not make it right. "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain" is a commandment which has not been suspended, regardless of any need to release tensions. He then offered the surprising observation that a nation confused for years by the teaching of situational ethics now finds itself dismayed by those in government who apparently practiced it. This oblique admission that profanity did not exhaust the evil practiced in the White House was welcome. But the implication that burglary, bribery, extortion, and perjury were somehow the result of an ethical approach whose primary tenet was, in all situations, seek to perform the truly loving act, underscored the truth in Graham's frequent insistence that he was no scholar. He did, however, claim to be a faithful friend, and he reiterated that claim in this statement. "Nixon," he said, "is my friend, and I have no intention of forsaking him now, nor will I judge him as a man in totality on the basis of these relatively few hours of conversation under such severe pressure." 4 days after Graham released this statement, Nixon called from Camp David for a 14-minute conversation, the longest the two men had had in 10 months, and apparently their last while Nixon was president. The content of that conversation is unknown, at least until the Watergate tapes themselves are eventually made public. But it did not restore the relationship to its former level of closeness. Graham spent most of July in Switzerland in connection with an international conference that would prove to be one of the most significant enterprises of his entire ministry. In his major address to the assembly, he drew sustained applause when he warned that evangelists must be careful not to identify the gospel with any one political program or culture, adding that this has been my own danger. When he returned to the United States, Nixon was all but finished. I tried to get to him, he remembered, to go have prayer with him, but I couldn't. The night before he resigned, I went to Washington at the urging of Senator Robert Griffin of Michigan, who asked me to come. He said, "Billy, you're the only one who can talk to Nixon, and he needs you." I just talked to Ed Cox, his son-in-law, and he said to tell you to come just as quick as you can. And I went, but I couldn't even get the operator to answer. I couldn't get anything. The day following Nixon's retreat to San Clemente, Graham observed that he felt sorry for the president and his family, adding that "I shall always consider him a personal friend. His personal suffering must be almost unbearable. He deserves the prayers even of those who feel betrayed and let down. We should let President Nixon and his family have some privacy now." When the new president, Gerald Ford, pardoned Nixon on September 8, Graham gave his blessing, stating that prosecuting the fallen leaders would have torn the country apart more than Watergate itself. By acting mercifully, Ford saved the country from the emotional division and agony that could have further weakened America at home and abroad. 10 days later, while he was in Los Angeles celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Great Crusade in the Canvas Cathedral, he talked briefly with the former president on the telephone. He asked if he might drop in for a visit. But Nixon, who seemed depressed, indicated it would not be a good time, both because he had a great deal of work to do and because phlebitis was causing terrible pain in his leg. Not long afterward, the phlebitis produced a blood clot that sent Nixon to the hospital, where Graham did manage to pay him a visit. He came pretty close to dying, Graham recalled. He was much sicker than people realized after his return to San Clemente to recuperate. Ruth hired an airplane and had a big sign following the plane saying, "Nixon, God loves you, and so do we." She did that because we couldn't get to him. The picture was in Time magazine, but nobody knew it was Ruth. Graham and Nixon finally reconciled the following spring over a 2.5-hour candlelight dinner at San Clemente. According to Graham, they never specifically mentioned Watergate. I'd say there was a studious avoidance of the subject by both of us. I certainly didn't want to bring it up. But Nixon did express some regret that he had let his friends down. Most of their conversation, he said, had been about the Bible and a book about the life of Christ that Nixon was reading. After dinner, the two of them had repaired to the study for a session of prayer. The former president, Graham said, had obviously suffered a great deal, but he voiced no recrimination and harbored no rancor toward those responsible for his downfall. Most important, it seemed obvious to Billy that Nixon had become deeply religious since his resignation. And that, it seemed, put the matter to rest. The evangelical doctrine of human depravity provided a useful clue to understanding what had happened, and Graham was quick to remind those with stones in their hands that there's a little bit of Watergate in all of us. Let's don't go around so self-righteous, talking about all those bad people. But that same theological system made it possible for him to shift the primary blame to external forces. As his official biography puts it, he eventually decided that Satan was somehow involved in the downfall of Nixon. He speculated that the enemy's weapons of choice had been sleeping pills and demons. As he explained to another chronicler, Nixon took all those sleeping pills that would give him a low in the morning and a high in the evening, you know? And all through history, drugs and demons have gone together. Demons have always worked through drugs. Even the Greek word for them both is the same. My conclusion is that it was just all those sleeping pills. They just let a demon power come in and play over him. As time passed, Graham seemed to have decided that what Satan had wrought may not have been so dreadful after all. With allegations concerning John Kennedy's amorous adventures surfaced late in 1975, he noted, that at least Nixon didn't have nude women running around in the private quarters of the White House. And a decade later, he had come to regard Watergate as little more than standard operating procedure for presidents. "They've all done that sort of thing," he pointed out. "Correctly, it appears. I could tell you about Johnson, about what he did, what he was doing to Goldwater, but I won't get into that at this point. I also read where Kennedy had certain conferences taped, and even back in Roosevelt's day, they had things on wire recordings. I don't guess they were private conversations, but they were things that he wanted to record." Nixon wasn't much different. But the difficulty is that he had it on tape. Sid Richardson told me years ago, "Don't put anything in writing. If you use the telephone, they can never use it against you." I follow that pretty well. I don't have much in writing. All my business is on telephones. You know, if Nixon hadn't kept those tapes, he never would have been in all that trouble. To keep a tape of his private conversations was his greatest mistake. But he made other mistakes. Though he indicated he and Nixon remained in touch, I see him very often. In fact, almost every time I go to New York. He acknowledged that their friendship was probably asymmetrical. "For years, I considered him among my very closest friends. I never thought of him for who he was. I just thought a great deal of him as a friend. He is one of the great people I've ever known personally who was a real gentleman. He's always courteous, always thoughtful. He would always ask about our meetings and the television programs, and he would comment on it. He was always very receptive when I would talk to him about spiritual things and his own relationship to the Lord and his family's relationship. He was always very respectful and very quiet. He didn't respond that much, but I could sense that he was responding inside. I think he considered me a close friend, but not one of his closest. I guess everybody has different levels of friendship." Reflecting on the possibility that the friendship between Graham and Nixon may have been asymmetrical, Charles Colson said, "That's true about Nixon with everyone. Nixon had a penchant for knowing how to use and manipulate people. He was the consummate politician. He would demand great loyalty, but as Watergate proved, he never quite gave it back." Although Graham acknowledged that maybe I was naive at that time, maybe I was used, he continued to insist that if any politician ever exploited a relationship with him, Richard Nixon was certainly not one of them. Still, the episode sobered him mightily and made him far more wary of patrolling the corridors of power. Early in 1989, he observed that inside the Beltway is a different world. "That's the reason I don't go there anymore, if I can help it. I'm glad I live down here on these mountains. I don't go to Washington much, and I don't go to the Hill much. I used to have lots of friends that I'd go back and see, congressmen and senators, but for years I haven't done that. I just don't want to go. I feel God has called me to a much higher calling." Friends and close co-workers confirm that the revelations of Watergate had a profound and chastening impact on the evangelist. Colson reported that, "Billy told me he would never make the mistake again for getting that close to someone in office. And I think he has been more careful with Reagan and Bush than he was with Nixon." Leighton Ford conceded that it was a great mystery to him. "I don't think he's ever gotten over it." All seem to agree, however, that Graham's insistence that Nixon's friendship was entirely non-political is sincere. Without tipping his own hand on the matter, Ford volunteered, "I've never heard him say one thing that made me believe he thought he was being used." Another close associate framed his assessment a bit more directly. "For the life of me," he said, "I honestly believe that after all these years, Billy still has no idea of how badly Nixon snookered him." Part 5. Keeping the Faith, 1974 to 1990. Chapter 27. Lausanne. In the Gospel accounts of Jesus' final meeting with his 11 faithful apostles, a few moments before he ascended into heaven, he gave them what came to be known as the Great Commission. "Go forth to every part of the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation. Those who believe it and receive baptism will find salvation. Those who do not believe it will be condemned." In August 1974, Time magazine noted that millions of Christians still take that commission of Christ literally, still believe that one of their foremost tasks is to preach the gospel to the unbaptized. Taken alone, that was a commonplace observation. But Time saw something uncommon afoot in the Christian world. Last week, it announced, in the Lakeshore Resort of Lausanne, Switzerland, that belief